Intervention, a podcast from the KTH Environmental Humanities Laboratory in Stockholm.
Hi, this is Eric Pagley in Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome to the relaunch of a podcast under the name of Intervention by the Environmental Humanities Laboratory at the Division of History of Science, Technology and Environment at KTH, Royal Institute of Technology, a lot of awards there. That's our institutional home that has now been turned into a center at KTH. We're going to talk about that and about this new and improved podcast, the Intervention Podcast from the EHL. Very happy to have the acting director of here in the studio, Adam Wickberry. He is a historian of media and environment at KTH, back from a couple of years in Berlin. And also James Dunk from the University of Sydney. He's a historian of medicine, psychology, and environment. So we have a couple of historians here to talk about the concept of environmental humanities and of planetary health. Adam, why don't we start with you, and why don't you give us an idea about what's going on at the lab, or the EHL, as we call it there at KTH. By the way, my name is Eric Paglia. I'm also a historian, environmental historian, also employed at KTH at the Division of History of Science, Technology, and Environment. So, Adam, tell us what's going on here at the lab. It's kind of an exciting moment right now, right?
Yeah.
With everything happening there, the lab has now become an official center at KTH. Maybe
right.
For a lot of listeners, that's not a big difference, but for us it is, and it entails a lot of new things going on. So tell us a bit about what's happening there.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, it's really exciting. We're growing, you could say, from the start 12 years ago now, from a small kind of experimental environmental humanities laboratory that's, you know, for those who've been following us for a long time, have seen us growing in terms of outreach and output and things we do. But now we're also growing at KTH. And for those of you who are academics, knows that can be a big deal, that KTH now officially recognizes us as one of their prioritized centers, which also means that they recognize environmental humanities as a prioritized area of research at a technical university that focuses on engineers. That is kind of a big deal. And for us, this is a moment of expanding our research lines. We already have a lot of work on political ecology, on climate activism, but now we're also looking more into the green transition, sustainability from a critical historical perspective, including digital issues, digital infrastructure related to environment, planetary governance, different strands of research. You can read more about that, obviously, on our website, kth.se.ehl, and I won't bore you with going through all of it right now, but just to give you an idea of it. But we're also expanding education, so we're hoping that environmental humanities education can be more used by people who are not usually in the humanities, because we think that there's a lot of potential in this kind of interdisciplinary outreach when you cross your humanities borders and go into other fields like science, technology, and of course medicine, that we have James here to talk about today. And I think that when we start working in these fields, reaching over and across and taking those leaps, a lot of exciting things are happening. Of course, we have to leave our comfort disciplinary backgrounds behind us, but I think it's really worth it. And yeah, as you said, Eric, a lot of new things are coming up. We're also starting a new center at the Division for Anthropocene History next year. That's not a part of the EHL, but it's growing out of that same rich environment that is the EHL and the Division at KTH, the same people basically involved. So we're also looking forward to that. And yeah, we have people coming to visit us, like James, so we're super happy to have him in Stockholm. I had him here for a couple of weeks, and it's really great that we could sit down and have a chat about planetary health.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have James here in town. We're going to talk about planetary health in a moment. I thought maybe it would be a good opportunity, James coming from Australia. Australian researchers have been part of this evolution of the concept of environmental humanities around the same time, I guess, as the EHL was launched 10, 12 years ago, and the field has developed in these years since then. From what Adam has described as some of the disciplinary ground that this concept entails, how is it interpreted in Australia? Is it significantly different? Or are you researching some of the same issues, some of the same concepts as EHL has done here in Northern Europe?
Yeah. My sense is that the environmental humanities were quite early to spring out of some of the problems and questions in Australian humanities. So it began not so much as a conversation between humanities and kind of sciences and social sciences, but mostly within the humanities and I suppose some of the humanities leaning social sciences, if you like. History, environmental history was a big force there, and anthropology, philosophy, I think, as well. This is quite early, so early 21st century. a lot of it based in Canberra, ANU, Australian National University. Of course, it's a long time since then now, it's 2 decades. And so while it was an early player, I think some of the energy struggled to find a foothold in certain Australian contexts, universities, networks. And so I'd say environmental humanities is not the strongest force in Australian kind of higher education or intellectual networks at the moment. Environmental history has been growing steadily enough as a force within history, as a presence. But now, I suppose, now with climate crisis bringing this pressure and bringing this kind of sense of urgency, not only in the humanities or social sciences, but in so many different areas, I think there's this opportunity for the humanities to really plunge in again or take up these questions. And a lot of that is core, crucial interdisciplinary work. So a centre like the Sydney Environment Institute, where I'm affiliated at the University of Sydney, is doing some really great work to bring people together across the university. It started quite small, led by a historian and a social scientist, a political scientist, but it's become this quite enormous, actually, gathering of people. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of work ahead, and it's important that the humanities, I think, stays right there in the middle of it.
What value added do you think having the broadening environmental history? Because I think a lot of, I mean, from Adam, you and my division, it's a history division, and this broadening of our scope to environmental humanities, do you think it gives us a stronger political voice, James is maybe entailing, that maybe to speak to society in a broader sense?
Yeah, you could say, I guess. There are different translations that need to be done for our academic, you know, work to reach out to a broader public, which I think all of us are really trying to do, and think consider an important part of why we do what we do. And the environmental humanities, of course, is not strictly related only to history, but has a lot of different other approaches, like multi-species justice, different approaches. Post-humanities is a part of that broader umbrella too, but also political ecology, environmental activism, and environmental justice, I would say, has been a core of it. But now I think increasingly, because it's so high on the political agenda, people are seeing within the environmental humanities that green transition, sustainability is everywhere on not just higher education institutions like KTH, but you know, politically, everyone is striving towards. And it's really, really important that we have like a critical grounded, humanities grounded voice to speak to these concepts and discourses and kind of scrutinize them and show how different power relations are reconfigured as we go about to change our world in the name of a green transition to halt climate change and biodiversity loss, for instance. But at the same time, we're creating new problems, we're opening new minds, and new people come to suffer. And all of these things are stuff that I think that environmental humanities scholars are particularly well equipped to attack and kind of show and communicate to a broader audience, including those who work directly with them, such as engineers and scientists and doctors and so on, but also the broader public in our all our countries as a kind of democratic dimension to our academic work.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier this idea of the Anthropocene History, the center that's going to be coming up at our division next year. Has that been a good tool, the concept of the Anthropocene, for bringing different scholars together within the humanities, but also reaching out? I mean, James, you mentioned the social sciences, Earth system sciences. I mean, I know some of the early work that on the Anthropocene was done by some collaborations with Libby Robin, environmental historian now retired, and Will Steffen, recently deceased Will Steffen, Earth system scientist. Is that the way forward also for the environmental humanities, to reach out further and further, maybe even beyond humanities, to work with natural scientists and other scholars?
Mm. I think so. I think there's a lot of potential. Again, it might not be for everyone, and some people will have to stick with what works for them. But I think there's a lot of potential for expansion with the environmental humanities following that model. And I, as you mentioned in the beginning, I just came back from 2 years in Berlin as a visiting scholar at the Max Planck Institute for History of Science. And we were collaborating a lot with the HKW, the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, the Museum of World Culture, where there's a concept that a colleague of mine, Christoph Rosol, started 10 years ago called the Anthropocene Curriculum. And there we gathered Earth system scientists who were really researching the Anthropocene geological strata of it with artists, activists, humanities scholars, historians, and everyone came together very nicely. Very, you know, the output was fantastic, and now there's a big archive out of, from those 10 years of work. The Hakave has a new fantastic director and a new orientation towards decolonial practices, which I think is great. But the Anthropocene curriculum now is surviving as a decentralized network called the Anthropocene Commons. You can also check that out, where we continue to work on along these research lines, but also with these collaborations. And it's really great to see how everyone from artists to scientists keep on working together with this kind of enthusiasm, although there's no like academic or institutional home for this network to work, because everyone has seen how well it has worked over these years. So I think, yeah, for environmental humanities, there's a lot of more potential in reaching out and across the disciplinary borders. It's great that it has started in the humanities and it needs to retain that core, but there's also some translational work to be done in working directly with other fields, I think.
I was actually part of an Anthropocene campus, which I think is maybe an offshoot from the original curriculum, which has sort of been held in different cities around the world. And this was in Melbourne a couple of years ago, I want to say 2018. Similar thing. So, I mean, it's interesting to see it decentralized, not only as the commons, but as this kind of physical gathering of scholars of different kinds that's taking place in different parts of the world as a way of, I suppose, broadening out this concept and not making it purely Eurocentric. It's one of these great meeting places, as you say, of different kinds of knowledge and practice. And it's important that the human in all of these meetings and different gathering points, the human remains a problem, a kind of a difficult category that we work with and see as a rich, deep, questionable, problematic, but also complicated and ideally a place where we can keep doing important work and insisting that that's part of the question. Part of the question around the Anthropocene is not only about the human effects on the world, but about the effects on the human of the human effects on the world.
How much has the Anthropocene concept caught on in Australia? I mean, you had when I think of the Anthropocene, I think of Will Steffen, even before I think of Paul Crutzen. I mean, did he manage to really to bring it into sort of everyday usage in Australia? Are people aware of the concept of the Anthropocene on a research level, on a political level, on a societal level?
I think the Anthropocene is one of those concepts that really divides, shows the division in society, in that there are some of us for whom it's an old and tired concept, almost, not quite tired, but it's been worked over so many times and it's become this deep problem in the ways that we understand. It's been renamed so many times as well by social theorists and scientists, humanists. But you use the term unguardedly and you might find people looking at you blankly because it's still, you know, it's a word that is not necessarily well known outside the academy. So I think there's a question there around it as a useful concept that helps to organize our inquiries but also our communications. Is it helpful for us to think about planetary history in this with this new name, a new era? And I think in lots of ways it is, so don't misunderstand that, yeah.
Actually, I think there's the Anthropocene concept, now that you bring it up, James, is a good example of how this traffic can work between humanities, sciences, and a broader public, because it was launched, it came from the Earth System Sciences, Will Steffen, as you said, and a lot of work was being done in Stockholm, actually, where we are now. Paul Crutzen coined it, and pretty quickly humanities and social scientists, scholars caught on and started criticizing and say, well, this is universalizing, well, you're leaving out all the multi-species actors, and you're also saying that, you know, we're all implied in this together, whereas, you know, the 1% or the Western white male dominance is actually much more complicit, whereas other parts of the global south are not. And, you know, all of this critique that you all probably know of, but that critique did not meet deaf ears, I think. It really caught on and it got into the discourse, into the broader science discourse. And you can see how, for instance, the great acceleration graphs that was made around 2005, I think, first, were then updated in 2015 to show this kind of differentiation between Global South and Global North as a response or as a way to better understand how different parts of the world are complicit in different parts of how we are changing the planet in the Anthropocene. And then I think that kind of critical understanding of what the Anthropocene is can and should also follow on now that the Anthropocene is being formally established, because maybe not all of those who listen know, but this summer the Anthropocene Working Group, would have been working for now 13 years to kind of investigate the stratigraphic basis for an Anthropocene, to see are there sites across the planet where we can see a clear new signal that we can then identify as anthropogenic, as an Anthropocene, to start this new epoch. They concluded their work this summer and presented a site in Canada, actually Lake Crawford, which is a sinkhole where you can see the signal really, really clearly around 1950. So that's also very contested in debate, but that's not how the Anthropocene Working Group is now going forward to the bodies of geological sciences. And then if all goes well, which I think is quite likely, then in about a year or a half, year and a half from now, we may have an official formal Anthropocene, meaning that the Anthropocene will be in every children's school book across the world following the Holocene. So we will have to explain, we will have to understand what does this mean. And the more critical thought, the more environmental humanities, for instance, kind of thinking, philosophical, historical, that goes into explaining how the Anthropocene came about, what it means, what the implications are, the better. Whereas if you just leave it to the science and say, okay, there's a new epoch, it's just a signal, then you lose the opportunity to actually highlight these things that you want to highlight.
So you think there'll be a greater political impact when and if it is accepted as a geological epoch?
That's the potential, but it won't come automatically. It entails a lot of work from people like us who are interested in doing that work, but I think there is a lot of potential. I think that's also one of the core ideas behind this Anthropocene History Center and projects that we are working towards, to kind of reformulate and revision modern history, especially post-war history, not forgetting about the colonial legacies and seeing how this all started with the Columbian Exchange in the 16th century, but then seeing how, as the great acceleration graphs make so abundantly clear, how it's all really accelerating, not in a mathematical sense, but in another sense, since the post-war to the present, and understanding why that happened, why we failed to curb those curves, what were the different discourses, technologies, actors involved, is a huge task ahead, but I think a really important one for our historical consciousness, basically, for people, not just academics, but the general public and the population, to know, okay, who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we going? Just as after the Second World War, you had to work through what happened in that war. What was the Holocaust? Why did it happen? How could it happen? Where are we going now? How can we avoid this happening? Something similar, not to say that it's the same, but something in terms of reworking our historical consciousness, I think is necessary in face of the Anthropocene, and even more so when it's formalized.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it's almost a permission or a level of access that's granted to that sort of historical meaning-making and questioning and reinterpreting, which is, I mean, it's been going on for some time, right? You know, Deepesh Chakrabarty wrote about this as a core problem for the humanities almost 15 years ago. But the naming by the scientists and the acceptance of that by, you know, I suppose, government departments and different frameworks for knowledge will be a crucial moment, as you say, in actually saying, this is a new era, this is a new moment, it's not just an idea. And that's an interesting point for us as humanists, that it's just one thing to say this is a new moment, there are new things at play here. It's another for kind of all these organizations and institutions to accept it and then invite further reflection on it.
And I think that's part of the challenge now, and that, as you mentioned, Chakrabarty's famous 2009 essay, I think it is, The Climate of History and Critical Inquiry, which is so hugely cited and influential. A lot of work followed that in those 14 years since, where he stated that the Anthropocene or climate change, really anthropogenic climate change, but let's say the Anthropocene, entails the collapse of the distinction between natural and human history. Which I think is very true and very important, but a lot of work has gone into then discussing this conceptual breach or overcoming of the breach that the modernity installed, but not so much actual like historical empirical work to show what happened in the Anthropocene, what was it on a kind of historical level. So in a way, we've done a lot of work in the humanities on a conceptual level, also debating the names and the implications, but not so much you know, getting our hands dirty and getting into to the Anthropocene. I think that's so the, a challenge is then to bring all that critical thinking that's been done by so many brilliant people into our future work as we kind of come to terms with living in the Anthropocene, which we are then by default or by fact doing.
Yeah, I think, as you say, a lot of us have been waiting for a long time for this official recognition, this golden spike, which I guess is coming, looks like it's coming fairly soon. So we should be ready to to seize that that moment that we've been waiting for 15, 20 years or so at this point. Okay, so the Anthropocene History Center, that's coming up next year, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about that on this podcast, developing the idea and in some of the ways that that will be applied in various ways. But now let's move over to another concept that we're very lucky to have James here to talk about, the idea of planetary health, which is something that, James, you've been working with for quite some time. It's another concept that's been around for, I don't exactly know, 10 years at this point, in parallel with some of these other ideas like the Anthropocene, but of course quite different. Perhaps tell us a bit about what that is and maybe give us a brief history of the concept itself.
Yeah, I mean, there are different timescales of that history. There's, in a sense, planetary health is very, very old. It's not a new idea. It's a very old idea that human health and the health of other species and places and systems, natural living systems, is interconnected. This is an idea that's very common in ancient philosophies and indigenous philosophies and approaches to the world and to health. And it's a place that a kind of an idea or set of ideas that's recurred throughout Western history as well in various places and times. There's also a medium-term history, so the later 20th century saw people talking about the planet in new ways, a new planetary imaginary emerging. And part of the concern there was around, or part of the framing there was around health. So the planet was seen to be sick, seen to be an kind of ailing entity, a complex, enormous patient. And part of that is a kind of there's a human hubris there to see, I suppose, if the planet is a patient, then there's a sense in which humans of one stripe or another are going to be the doctors. And of course, that's a questionable metaphor to use. But in around 2014. People in London, Richard Horton and Andy Haynes and others started asking about the possibility of a new discipline, a sort of second public health 2.0, which took into account not only local environments and pollution and contaminants in the way that environmental health has done for a long time, but took into account these new understandings or senses of Earth systems being disrupted. So it's very much an Anthropocene framing that informs and underpins planetary health. It looks to Anthropocene and it looks to the planetary boundaries framework that is also kind of wrapped around that Anthropocene and gives it a diagrammatic, a visualizable nature, this sort of planet ringed by deadly thresholds that must not be crossed under any circumstances. And so planetary health emerged around 2014-15. There was a Lancet Rockefeller Commission, Bellagio, where a 50-page document was assembled to show the various ways in which human health at scale was interdependent with the health, the integrity of these Earth systems. And since then, it's been an interesting movement. It's something between a research field, a discipline, as it's been called sometimes, or an interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary meeting space for new forms of knowledge and methodology. But also there's something of a popular movement around planetary health. It's quite a powerful idea once you get past the original strangeness there of using health as a metaphor for the planet, which seems, you know, there's a clash there, isn't there, in the way we hear that or receive that in our minds. But once you get past that, it becomes this quite powerful call. Planetary health has the same potential, perhaps, as these kinds of earlier claims of you know, think local, think global, act local. Sorry. Planetary health is this efficient phrase that can perhaps help people to see our own health, our own interests are very intimately bound up in the interests of the status of the planet and its systems. And then it's a question of scaling. Can we bring that top level scale, the image of the planet, however we want to visualize it in our own minds and imaginations, can we bring that into a practical, useful frame to help shape our own lives, our research practices, our efforts in health and medicine, which of course are an enormous amount of where we place our resources as societies towards our own well-being. Can we then bring the well-being of the planet into that and use those resources direct those resources in ways that are much more sustainable, much more promoting of the life of other species and systems?
That is really, really interesting, James, and I really come to think about when you're hearing you talking about planetary health in this kind of presentation of the concept and its history. As we're in Stockholm, we just talked about the Anthropocene. I come to think about global health and Hans Rosling and this kind of other work, which at least to me, and let me see if I get this right, because you're the one who would know, that to me global health seemed to come out of the kind of global development ideas that, you know, improving human health maybe at the cost of the environment sometimes, in kind of industrial effort to make sure that everyone gets lifted out of poverty by means that are not always sustainable, that were not always sustainable. Whereas planetary health seems to be on the other side of that, coming out of how things that humans are doing are then recursively returning to them through, because they are planetary inhabitants. So am I getting it right, more or less? Could you say something more about that, you know, connection between global health and planetary health?
That's right, yeah. So part of the framing statement of planetary health is that these enormous gains in human health, which you can think of in terms of global health, although that's often about correcting some of these gains and kind of redistributing some of the resource and gains that have been made in, you know, high-income societies into other societies. So part of it is saying that those gains have actually been made at the expense of the health or integrity of planetary systems, which means it's this very unsustainable trajectory that we've been on in terms of our own health. So it's a kind of a correction, a great correction that's being called for here, to look at not only the body and not only the population the human population, but to look at the whole. Look at all the systems. So it's a systems view, which is concerned not only with health and how we promote it at that level, but with the whole function of society. So how do our food systems, how do our economies and our political systems, energy systems particularly, how do they contribute or ultimately perhaps hinder human well-being? And there is, of course, as I said, human well-being, and that's partly because I think that's still front and center of the planetary health frame. Is it's about promoting human well-being and then taking into the other view, the wider view, the whole, into consideration in that promoting of human well-being. Now, people can argue about this and have, but I think it still has that health, public health and biomedical focus on human interests. And that's an ethical question that is unsolved, I think.
I mean, in the middle of this 10-year history of the latest incarnation of the concept of planetary health came the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. How did that impact? I mean, when you think of planetary health, you think almost immediately of the recent pandemic, which, of course, the origins can be debated and discussed. But a lot of people said that even if this particular pandemic was not the result of changes in land use that brought humans in closer contact with species that carry certain viruses, how did the pandemic affect thinking on planetary health and also the just general interest in the topic?
Yeah, I mean, during the pandemic, there were some quite early calls connecting planetary health concerns with the pandemic. As you say, these questions about the human-animal health boundary, the way that this virus may or may not have crossed over from other species into the human kind of system. And then some broader implications there, as you say, around the changing ways that we use land and the encroachment of human societies on land and the growing burden that's being placed. I think it hasn't fundamentally changed the planetary health program. It's one indicator of these deep interdependencies. And sometimes it became evident in this counterintuitive ways, you know, that if we draw down our impacts by shutting down certain parts of our social operations, by locking down in Australia as we did several times, then it kind of but by drawing down, showed some of those connections in a different light and threw relief on them. In other ways, it was a great distraction from some of the concerns of planetary health, because in many ways, the pandemic was treated in this very 20th century contaminationist sense, in which there was a microbe that was the fault. You know, we were all able to visualize it, this coronavirus, and that it was then a medical and a political event around protecting humans from that microbe. And so, in a sense, it a lot of the ways that it was treated was not in terms of systems, not in terms of the longer view, not in terms of planetary history, but in these very local, immediate, and in some ways quite limited ways. Also, particularly in Australia, it took the focus away from this devastating heat event, climate change event that we had in 2019-20, the Black Summer fires. And there had been a moment where a lot of attention was turned towards climate change and towards its devastating impact on humans and on other species and on country, on the planet even. But the pandemic really showed this kind of prevailing limited interest in biomedical and human health concerns that turned to the fore at that point.
I guess competing crises, I guess, is only so much attention that society has to address these major complex problems. And you're also involved with perhaps you can tell us a bit about the research project you're involved with now that launched, I think it was last year, financed by the Australian Research Council, right?
Yeah, this is a discovery project, an Australian Research Council discovery project called Planetary Health Histories, Developing Concepts. And it's really one of these examples of environmental humanities interdisciplinary working. It's we have on the team a medical historian, Warwick Anderson, who's the lead CI, Sverker Sorlin here in Stockholm, an environmental historian, among other things, Jacqueline Troy, an Indigenous scholar and linguist at the University of Sydney, and Anthony Capon, who was on that Lancet Rockefeller Commission in 2014 and is now the director of the Monash Sustainable Development Institute at Monash University. So it's a mix of disciplines, a mix of ways of approaching the problem, but we're all united in this interest in planetary history, in the meeting of human and other health systems, and also critical questions around how those knowledge systems meet and how those languages meet. How do we talk about human and planetary health? And how do we understand perhaps the space or the chasm often between thinking about medical governance and medical ways of understanding and thinking about environmental governance, environmental regulation, and thinking about ecosystems and the health of ecosystems. So as a project team, we're exploring this conceptual history of planetary health, trying to look further and see where it came from, these histories of disease ecology, of epidemiology, of human ecology, and then trying to understand also particularly where it might intersect with Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous science and views of health.
Yes, I was wondering with regards to that conceptual history of planetary health, I find it really interesting. So I wanted to ask you, like, is there an intersection with the Gaia hypothesis by James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis' work? Because it seems to me that there would be, but that's way back to the 1960s, for those of you who don't know, which was then foundational, of course, to Earth system science, kind of holistic view of the planet, but was also very much contested to be kind of a hippie, gibberish, new agey, because of the word Gaia, but also because of the idea that the planet then was functioning to keep homeostasis and all living things, the biosphere, you know, strives to keep itself at the conditions where life can live and thrive. So what are the connections with the Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, and what role does it play, do you think?
The Gaia hypothesis hasn't been a large part of our exploration so far, and I think the direct lines are few between those who formed this planetary health concept around in the later 20th, early 21st century, which is partly, including, I'm thinking here, the environmental epidemiologist, Tony McMichael, who from around 1990 started writing quite a lot about climate change and health, and then thinking quite structurally around human societies and health and the environmental and systems, ecosystems, underpinnings of those of societies. But, I mean, there are obvious parallels, particularly with the work that I've been doing in planetary mental health, which does start to consider the ways in which the Earth might be able to be considered as a living entity, as in some sort of relationship, active, reciprocal relationship with human individuals, with humans collectively. And there are a lot of affinities between the Gaia hypothesis and many indigenous concepts of Mother Earth, of a planet which is sentient, which is has active relationships with its kind of various species and various living parts. Of course, those haven't always been taken seriously by Western science, and the Gaia hypothesis, as you say, it met a lot of resistance and continues to. It's one of those concepts that's moved beyond the, not unlike the Anthropocene, it's moved beyond the scientific origins and has been taken up quite vigorously, or with quite a lot of enthusiasm, both as a concept for humanists and others, but also as a popular concept. It's a sort of a Western and meeting place of some of those other older ideas about Mother Earth, I think.
Yeah. Can we talk more about kind of non-Western cosmologies and planetary mental health? I find that really interesting. We talked about that the other day. Could you tell us more about how there may be like potential to, or even a need to explore other than the dominant Western cosmologies that we've lived with in modernity, to understand how our mental health is affected and can maybe be improved outside of the cosmology, because there seems to me to be something very interesting but also hard to kind of grasp in that context.
So for decades, really, there's been this effort to reckon with some of the deficiencies of Western ways of thinking about humanity, about the self, about psychology, about who we are and what we're doing. I mean, it's not decades old. It's as old as humans, I think. But there have been quite concerted efforts towards the end of the 20th century to undo or move beyond these dualistic ideas, these splits between mind and body, between human and nature and culture. This isn't new. This is kind of core problems for the humanities over the last little while. Planetary health, in a sense, presents this new opportunity to deal with these questions in a community that's perhaps been less interested in them, in health communities, that is, public health, in biomedical communities, and people who've thought quite focusedly about humans. There are now these questions about, well, what are the underpinnings of human health, and how do we effectively move through some of those barriers in the way that we do it? In terms of planetary mental health, there is, I think, some quite articulate and quite clear views that have been expressed in leading medical journals. These are from Indigenous scholars, Indigenous knowledge bearers and carriers, who have made these claims very clearly within this planetary health framing to say, this is how we see the world, this is our cosmology, this is even shared or similar cosmologies across various Indigenous societies. I'm thinking of an article by Nicole Redvers and her colleagues published in 2022 in The Lancet, or The Lancet Planetary Health, which is a sort of consensus view. And it lays out 10 determinants of planetary health from this Indigenous consensus perspective. And part of it is this whole different cosmology, a whole different framework for what a human is, where their place is in time and in space, how they relate to other creatures. And you're right that this is a difficult area, because it's not that there are a set of guidelines for Western practitioners or Western individuals to take up and say, here is how we can kind of move towards a more healthful connections, this kind of emotional and social well-being approach that emerges out of Australian and other Indigenous cultures, knowledge systems. And yet at the same time, there is some quite articulate suggestions that actually there is space here for convergence. There is space here for people to take up these views and take up these places, these kind of ideas, and move towards a different way entirely. But it, I think, requires an openness on the part of Western global individuals, but also these knowledge frames and health systems even. And I mean, as I say it, it's clear that we're a way away from there, I think.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Just to kind of round things off, we've brought up a lot of different concepts. Maybe not quite on the level of cosmologies, but concepts, I guess, are important from almost like scholarly cosmologies, whether it's the Anthropocene or the environmental humanities, or I mentioned Gaia, planetary health. How important do you think these concepts, not those in particular concepts, but concepts in general are as scholars, as concerned citizens that are trying to change the world in various ways? How important do you think these concepts are in our work?
I can go first. Yeah, I think they're very important, but I think it's even more important that we understand them critically as tools for communication that are not neutral by default, that they are loaded with meaning, and that people, ourselves and others, load them with meaning. And that's a responsibility that you need to be careful with, that concepts have a lot of power, but it's important to understand how they work, to see what's behind them, what kind of ideas, values, and so on are communicated when you use a particular concept, which is not always done with so much care, I find.
Yeah, and I suppose as well as the back end about how the concepts come into being and what forces shape those pathways, I suppose I'm also interested in how the concepts are used, so these kind of practical studies around how the concepts go out into the world, how they're actually taken up and become part of the shaping of ordinary experience of people. So that's partly intellectual, partly kind of effective. How are these concepts actually surrounding us and shaping life?
Yeah, in the best case scenario, they can be a vehicle for positive and important change, such as the idea behind sustainable development, some people would argue, but then other people would argue that sustainable development is a concept that's actually a smokescreen for continued extractivism and exploitation of the environment on a global scale and thus unhelpful. So I think it's the point I'm trying to make is that you have to understand that they can work both ways, and we need to be aware of that.
All right. Well, Adam and James, fantastic to have you here in the studio for the relaunch, the inaugural first episode of the Relaunch Intervention Podcast from the EHL, and we'll be doing more episodes like this. And James, great having you here in Stockholm. Welcome back, part of the network around the Environmental Humanities Laboratory here in Stockholm.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric.